All right. Well, tell you what, wanted to start with this in case, because folks were asking. First off, is everybody hot, cool? Do we need to turn the fan on? It's warmer than it usually is, so y'all let me know if we need to turn the fan on. We'll do that. So people that have asked, I'm going to do this real quick. If you have asked about where do I find the teaching for the church, if you go to southspring.org, you go to the website and you click on teaching, how convenient, teaching, and you go down after you've clicked on that, you can get to, this is not working. Let's try that again. I wonder if the website's, if my Wi-Fi has gone out. It's a bad start, right?
You're going to miss this next week.
And evidently the internet is no longer working. So that's what this is looking like. Okay, well, never mind. So if you go to the South Spring website, you click on teaching, it's got, at the top will always be last week's sermon. So the sermon series that we just started in 1 Peter is right there right now. But if you go down below that, there's a little box that says verse by verse. Click on that and you can go back and you can go back and listen to any of the teachings that we've done over the last couple of years. So that's where that is. Wow, that is, internet is very unhappy right now. So. Did it go? Hey, there it came. Okay, so if you go down, there's 1 Peter. You can see the Nehemiah series, the podcast they do on Wednesdays, the in-between, where they talk about what they're teaching, and here's verse by verse. So if you click on verse by verse, you can go back there. You can see me with no beard. And then you can see we go back all the way. As you can see, we've been in Genesis a while. But if you go back to older entries, you can go back and do other things. So, all right, guys, I will just go ahead and tell you now, Bible drill day. Okay, we are going to be all over the place, and I'm going to need lots of help. So pull out your Bibles, iPads, iPhones, iDevice, whatever it is. We'll see who's fastest today. It's going to be like a Bible drill. I'm going to start with this passage, okay? This is Psalm 82. So if you guys would go to Psalm 82, we're going to begin by reading this one together because this is going to create a framework for everything else we're doing today. So if you would, follow along with me. And this is actually in the ESV here, okay? Psalm 82, starting with verse 1. God has taken his place in the divine council. In the midst of the gods, he holds judgment. How long will you judge justly and show partiality to the wicked, Selah? Give justice to the weak and the fatherless. Maintain the right of the afflicted and the destitute. Rescue the weak and the needy. Deliver them from the hand of the wicked. They have neither knowledge nor understanding. They walk about in darkness. All the foundations of the earth are shaken. I said, you are gods, sons of the Most High, all of you. Nevertheless, like men, you shall die and fall like any prince. Arise, O God, judge the earth, for you shall inherit all the nations. All right. So let's just start with your observations. Anything odd strike you in this passage? Stuff in there that looks weird.
The whole first verse.
Okay. What do you mean?
Oh, God has taken divine counsel in the midst of the gods.
Okay. Does that rattle anybody's cage? What, anybody wondering what on earth that might mean? Anything else? Who's he talking to? That's a...
Not men, because verse 7 says life.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody else.
It is not men he's talking to.
Well,
Anything else? Well, I just wanted to let that one sit with you before we started today, because this is going to create a framework for the rest of our discussion today and into next week. As usual, I thought I knew what I was going to get covered today. We're not. This is going to go into next week and probably the week after that, which is okay. You may be thinking, hey, Keeling, we were in like the Tower of Babel last week. What on earth is this about? Well, it has everything to do with the Tower of Babel and what happened last week. Okay, so in review, we're going to do this pretty quickly. If you'll remember, over the last couple of weeks, we've gotten to the end of the first, what's kind of considered the first half narratively of the chapter of the book of Genesis. We have Genesis 1 through 11. It's this major kind of wide-angle lens approach to humanity and God's dealing with humanity. And then in chapter 12, which we'll eventually get to, you start to focus in on one individual and one family. But everything in 10 through 11 leads us to that. They're not completely disconnected stories. In fact, they're intimately connected stories, and we'll talk about how starting today. So if you go back to chapter 10, remember, chapter 10 was the Table of Nations. Chapter 10 was the sons of Noah. We've had this judgment event where God cleanses the earth. He starts over with Noah. Noah's like a new Adam. He has these kids, and then they get parceled out, right? We have these 70 nations that are spread out geographically all over the known world at that time. And then specifically, we start to focus in a little bit on this guy right here, Nimrod, who creates or who has a great name, right? A hunter. And then in chapter 11, we get this story of them building a tower to the gods on the plain of Shinar, which is going to be Babylon. And why did they do it? They said, come, let us make bricks and bake them thoroughly. They used bricks instead of stone. Tar from mortar then said, come, let us build ourselves a city with a tower that reaches to the heavens so that we may make a name for ourselves. That name for ourselves is going to be an important literary thing we're going to see, especially moving forward, because there's a difference between people making a name for themselves and the Lord making your name great. And we're going to see this distinction, especially once we get into chapter 12. And then it says, otherwise we'll be scattered. So this is Babylonia. We've got this technology. And we talked last week kind of in the popular imagination about how we've got these weird ideas of what the Tower of Babel was. Was it really this like sky tower kind of thing? And we know in our modern sensibilities of, well, what's a tower to the heavens? Well, you're probably thinking about something that like goes up into space or something like that. But that is not at all what they're talking about. And if you go back and you look at what the language says, you look at what's actually been found in Babylon, and you look at the theological worldview of the ancient Middle East, you know what they're talking about is a ziggurat. And a ziggurat were these temples of worship where they said that basically they were meant to be like a mountain, a cosmic mountain. On the top, you had an altar where the god would come down. They would then ask the god to come down into an idol. They would take that idol to worship. And specifically, we said that the Tower of Babel, pretty much everyone agrees in the historical community, the archaeological community, that the place that's being referred to is called Intimananki, which the only thing left there is the foundation. It was something that was built thousands and thousands of years ago and subsequently went into decline and then rebuilt. This is something that Nebuchadnezzar rebuilt with the return of Babylon. Now, we're talking about ancient Babylon. Babylon's one of those places that was built and rebuilt, built and rebuilt, built and rebuilt. And this was the most ancient description of that particular temple. And this isn't Intinanki. If I showed you the picture of Intinanki, basically the only way they even know it's there is they had to see it from the air where they can actually see the foundations. There's like a pond there now. So that's really all that's left. So in review, this whole story is meant to be a round out of the first half of Genesis. God created order from disorder in chapter 1. God met man on a cosmic mountain of his own creation in a garden. Spiritual beings rebelled. One particular spiritual being rebelled, who is referred to as a serpent. There's a Hebrew word there that also means fiery one. Come back to that. Man chooses for himself good and evil, and therefore is going to allow sin to enter the world. He is going to be removed from the Garden of Eden and therefore removed from the Tree of Life. The Tree of Life is what gave man immortality, that allowed him to live forever. Without access to the Tree of Life, man will die. And so they are expunged, they're put out. But we continue to see, this is not just, and this is kind of, I think, where maybe there's a little bit of a deficiency maybe in our tradition about the view. And when I say our tradition, I mean our modern traditions. I don't necessarily mean the traditions of the church, because if you go back and look at the history of the church, a lot of this stuff has been lost because we are moderns. We are Enlightenment moderns. And so we, although we say we believe in this spiritual stuff, we have a tendency to disregard a lot of things in the Old Testament because we want to say, well, they were just trying to describe what they know. That's not the way the church viewed it, okay? So in that, there were actual other spiritual beings and they've been in rebellion too. And we're going to kind of get to that today. So these spiritual beings continue this disorder. We talked about that with the rise of the Nephilim. God responds with a chaos of the flood. We get a new Adam. The descendants of Noah are distributed. Man congregates, builds a new cosmic mountain so they can make a name for themselves. God disperses them with new languages. There we go. That brings us to this idea that I'm going to focus on today. And it's the idea of not only this table of nations concept, this idea that the nations were spread out, but if you kind of grasp the things we're talking about today, it will completely open up the Old Testament for you, and it will make you view Jesus' mission in a very different way. And that's where we'll eventually get. So we're going to start with this. So first question that you might be asking is this whole idea that the table of nations, this is sometimes referred to as the inheritance of the nations. And there's this idea or concept that God handed over these other nations to lesser Elohims, to lesser gods, to be their gods. And God, Yahweh, said, but this people are mine. You see this very clearly in Deuteronomy chapter 32. Now, this is the song of Moses. This is Moses on the back end of his ministry. He's about to die. He's about to hand off authority to Joshua. And this is what he says in Deuteronomy 32, verses 7 through 8. Remember the days of old. Consider the years of many generations. Ask your fathers and he'll show you, your elders and they'll tell you. When the Most High gave to the nations their inheritance, when he divided mankind, he fixed the borders of the peoples according to the number of the sons of God. But the Lord's portion is his people. Jacob is his allotted heritage. So there's an idea here, and we're just gonna kind of pile these ideas up, is that God disinherited the nations. I'm probably not spelling that right. He disinherited the nations. Specifically, notice a mention of a number there. According to the what? According to the number of the sons of God. Now, interesting. I want to ask any of you guys. Do any of you guys have a different translation there?
Heavenly Take court.
What's that?
Heavenly court.
Heavenly court. Instead of sons of God, it says heavenly court. That's interesting. What translation is that?
I don't know. You know that one.
No, that's an interest. I like that translation.
Usually, NLT.
New Living Tribe. Okay, that makes sense. That makes sense. Anybody else?
I've got when he separated the sons of Adam.
Okay, sons of Adam.
Sons of Israel.
Okay, sons of Israel. What translation is that?
NLV.
Okay. Anybody else?
NIV.
Okay. How many of you have ESV? I know that's the church. We kind of use the ESV kind of as the teaching one.
It's what does the
Septuagint says sons of Adam.
Okay. Any others? Okay, so here's the thing. That passage right here depends on which... Okay, we're going to do a little Bible geekery here this morning, okay? For much of the Bible's translation history into English, we're talking about the King James Version, and then earlier than that, you can talk about the Wycliffe translation, all those, the Latin Vulgate. Those translations were based on what was called the Masoretic Text, okay? The Masoretic Text is the definitive Jewish translation. I actually taught on this a long time ago when we weren't recording things, where it's the difference between the Old Testament text that is kind of the authorized Jewish text, which was by and large authorized by later rabbinic writings post first century AD. And I mean all the way up into the Middle Ages, okay? As opposed to a much earlier versions of the text we have, which are things like the Septuagint, okay? Which are in Greek. The reason that Jewish scholars did not like the Greek is because it was Greek. It was not Hebrew, and they wanted the Hebrew. The problem is they made translations out of the Greek back into Hebrew later on, and many of the changes were editorial changes based on theology. And one of them, for instance, is this idea that this is sons of Israel, okay? Now, here's the problem. If you did this and you said this is the sons of Israel...
I misread it. It says they divided the sons of Adam according to the number of God's angels.
Okay, that was going to say. I was going to say, the Septuagint is this...
Wrong.
Yeah, is this version. A lot of the Masoretic text, the NIV being one of them, they basically had this not referred to as that. It's the sons of Israel, which means this idea that they divided up, the idea of dividing the tribes of Israel. Problem is, it doesn't make sense because there was no Israel when the dividing happened. I mean, when the dividing happened, Israel hadn't been called yet. There was no tribes. There was none of that. That doesn't make any sense. So anyway, so most modern translations go all the way back to the Septuagint. And that's kind of the whole point, is the more we find out these older texts, the more it tells us about what that first century worldview of the Christian church was like, which is really kind of cool. So this is Moses' description of the Table of Nations, this idea that the nations were handed over. Now, guys, if you go in and you start reading the New Testament, you're going to see some of this language also. You're going to see it in Paul in the book of Romans. In the book of Romans, there's some passages in there where he talks about people being handed over to their own desires. There's another passage if you want to look at, and we're going to get... I'm trying to stay out of the New Testament this week, but Paul also in the book of Acts, when he's on the Areopagus, when he meets on Mars Hill and he's talking to the Greeks, and he talks about you've got an inscription over there to the unknown God. Well, you know that the gods were handed out. There's this idea that there was this handing over, and this idea that Israel was God's chosen group. Okay, everything you see moving forward in the Old Testament should be seen through that lens. Now, the question becomes, so why did he hand them over? Well, because he was frustrated, number one, and was moving in the direction of continuing to keep the promise of Genesis chapter 1 when, and 2 and 3, right? This idea that we're going to return to Eden and it's going to come through a line. It's going to come through a seed. And there's going to be this crushing of rebellion that's already happened in Eden, that happened with spiritual beings, right? And so this idea was, fine, you guys want to decide right and wrong for yourself, I'm going to hand you over to these other lesser parts of my divine counsel. You guys worship them. I'm going to take this group, and they're mine, okay? Now, if all those other lesser Elohims behaved, maybe that would have worked out. But it's obvious moving forward that those other Elohims don't... And by the way, I'm using language here. If you've been here since Genesis chapter 1, you know that's a phrase that's used in the Old Testament for gods, little g gods. Sometimes Yahweh is referred to as an Elohim, and that just literally means a spiritual being, a God, okay? So when we say, okay, so go back to Psalm 82. For you guys that just, your hair nearly caught on fire when you're just like, gods, okay, this idea. We're monotheists. Yes, we are. The term that's being used there is this old term, Elohims, which means spiritual beings of some sort, okay? So let's keep going. What are some other passages? And now I'm going to need some help, all right? So I am going to turn you over to these passages. So Deuteronomy 4, 19 and 20. Who wants that one? You got it. Deuteronomy 17, 2 through 3. You got it. 29, 25 through 26. You got it. 32, 16 through 17. You got it. We'll all go over to Daniel 10, okay? We're going to all go there. And then, of course, Psalm 82. So let's do this. Deuteronomy 4, 90. And by the way, reminder, what are these passages? Exodus is the story of Moses and Israel, right? And the calling of Israel out of Egypt. Deuteronomy is a further description of that, and also descriptions of the law, okay? And speeches that Moses gave. So let's start with Deuteronomy 4, 19 through 20. Okay, so let's stop there before we go any further. What are some things that jump out at you in that passage? What are some like words that just like pop out at you? Okay. What else? Okay. Notice the inheritance language, right? What else? Is there anything else about this one that strikes you as what is he basically telling the Israelites? Don't do what? Okay. Specifically, sun, moon, stars. What's that? Okay. Any other different translations? Okay. Host of heaven. Okay. So, in our modern sensibilities, when we hear the term "don't bow down to the sun, moon, and stars," what do we think? What do we think these people are doing? Astrology? What else? Okay. Anybody have this kind of, almost this condescending, they were worshiping the stars, the moon, really worshiping the moon. How simple of them, right? That idea? Okay. You need to remember, in Genesis 1, when God creates the starry host, that was the way those folks understood spiritual beings. That was like the sky was different from the earth. That's where spiritual beings were. So when they saw stars, they thought spiritual beings. And yes, that is where the ideas of astrology and stuff like that come from. When they see the sun, that represented a spiritual being. The moon, that represented a spiritual being. So when it says that, he's literally saying, don't worship them, okay? By the way, that also assumes, were people worshiping them? Yes, they were. Okay, let's keep going. Deuteronomy 17.
If there is found among you, with any of your towns, the Lord your God is giving you, a man or a woman who does what is evil in the sight of the Lord your God, in transgression of his covenant, and has gone and served other gods and worshiped them, for the sun or the moon or any of the host of heaven, which I have forbidden.
Sound familiar? Same thing. I told you how to worship. I told you how to worship me. If you find somebody, and this is so important for understanding how the Israelites dealt with outsiders and folks that broke covenant inside, and how they dealt with the conquest when they were told to go in and take certain pieces of land, that kind of thing. Okay? 29, 25 through 26.
Had not known and whom he had not allotted to them.
Once again, you hear that same kind of inheritance language. You're not allotted to them. I handed other people over to them. That's that idea. You're mine. You're my inheritance. I'm doing something with you, not with them. And then 32, 16 and 17.
They made him jealous with strange gods. With abominations, they provoked him to anger. They sacrificed to demons who were not gods, to gods whom they had never known, new gods who came lately, whom your fathers did not dread.
Okay. So once again, we might be tempted to think of these idols because we see the same language. Paul even uses this language. It's like, are you really worshiping something that was made, you know, something that was made with stone and straw and gold and that kind of thing? But yes, it says here things that were not gods, but then it turns right back around and says what? That they were what?
They were.
Yeah, they were gods, okay? They were Elohims, okay? And you see that kind of language there. All right.
I have a question.
Yes.
So it's okay to worship the gods that are allotted to them?
Well, that is a fantastic question. I would venture to say nope, because the way Paul kind of deals with it is like he gave the people what they wanted. You don't want me? Your will be done. It's kind of that C.S. Lewis passage. At the end of the day, we're all going to say thy will be done. You're either going to tell me thy will be done or God's going to tell people your will be done. And that's kind of the idea, is that this turning over, and some of this is a mystery, and that's kind of the other thing for us to kind of approach all this with humility. We can only know what we know, and one of the most difficult things to know is how does that whole divine counsel thing work? So hold that question because we're going to come back to it, because I think that's a really, really good point, I think. So what do we got so far? God's inheritance of Israel is to fulfill his promise to the garden. God's disinheritance of the nations handled them over to lesser Elohim. There's a rebellion of these lesser Elohim and God's judgment on them. So let's keep going. So let's look at in particular. So we've got this rebellion. Obviously, you had this rebellion in Genesis chapter 6 where the sons of God came down to the daughters of men, and you've got this creation of Nephilim. So there was a rebellion there, okay? There's also this rebellion that we saw on the first pages of the book, right? Right out of the gate, we see this rebellion in the garden. The question is, are there other references to that particular rebellion? So I want us to go and look at Isaiah 14. Who wants to read Isaiah 14 for us? Anybody? Okay. And Ezekiel 28. Anybody want Ezekiel 28? All right. Perfect. Okay. And if you can, let's all try to go there on these because these are kind of interesting. And by the way, we're going to spend a lot of time in Isaiah before we move on. Now, reminder, Isaiah is a prophet of Israel, one of the most important. And a lot of the passages that Isaiah is going to put forward are going to be things that have to do with Messiah and all of this stuff that's going on. So Isaiah 14, go for it.
How you are fallen from heaven, O shining star, son of the morning. You have been thrown down to the earth, you who destroyed the nations of the world. For you said to yourself, I will ascend to heaven and set my throne above God's stars. I will preside on the mountain of the gods far away in the north. I will climb to the highest heavens and be like the Most High.
Okay. So, tell me a little bit about this being. What did this being do?
Wanted to be like God.
Wanted to be like God. By doing what? What are some things that it did?
Be above God.
Okay. Anything else?
I will make myself like the Most High.
Okay, that reference to the Most High being King of the gods, Yahweh, right? The Most High God. What else?
Climb to the highest heavens.
We'll climb to the highest heavens, like a mountain of God, right? What else?
Be a part of the assembly.
Yes, I will sit on the mount of the assembly. Mountains, really important. Where's his throne? I will raise my throne above the stars of God, right? Okay, so evidently, there's one particular Elohim who really gets singled out by Isaiah here for a little bit of scrutiny, right? And this description of the, okay, so here's what's wild. Who do we think we're talking about here, by the way? If you had to guess.
Satan.
We're talking about Satan, right? Okay, so here's the thing. Satan is an Elohim, but we don't even necessarily have that name for him, okay? By the way, what does Satan even mean? Do you guys know what Satan means? The opposer or the accuser. In fact, the only time we see this name actually used is where? Do you guys know? In Job, which is another weird story, right? God's hanging out. There's other angels there. This one angel comes in. Yahweh brags on Job. This particular angel says, well, you know, if I did this, this, and this, would he really? Okay. It's hard to know for sure if that's even necessarily the same Elohim we're talking about here. But it becomes synonymous later on with the name, okay? Names are important, but we've got all sorts of different names. In this one, what's his name?
Morning Star.
Morning. Yeah. Well, there's that star language again, so we come back to that, okay? So let's look at the next one. And by the way, if you really want to go down this rabbit trail, here's what's great about this. If you pass up a little bit, and by the way, what you see with Isaiah will oftentimes be talking about a real king and a real person, and about halfway through him riffing on the judgment against that person, it slips over into this spiritual condemnation of a spiritual being behind that throne. And that's an important thing to keep in mind. But especially if you consider, who do these other kingdoms belong to? They don't belong to, you know, Yahweh handed them over, right? So you've got this power behind the thrones. That's a really important concept.
On mine it says, O day star, son of dawn. What's son of dawn?
It's this idea that was an honorific. That was an honorific title that was given.
It's translated in OSB as Lucifer.
Okay, there you go. So what names?
But Jesus is also called the morning star in other passages too.
Yep. So Lucifer. And see, I'll be honest, I was not planning on making this a lesson about Satan this morning. That's a couple of months later. Who knows how long that would take. But suffice it to say, we know we've got a character here, okay? Let's read more about this character. Ezekiel 28, and if you want to turn over there, this is another passage.
Sardius, topaz and diamond, beryl, onyx and jasper, sapphire, emerald and carbuncle, and crafted in gold were your settings and your engravings. On the day that you were created, they were prepared. You were an anointed guardian cherub. I placed you. You were on the holy mountain of God. In the midst of the stones of fire, you walked. You were blameless in your ways from the day you were created till unrighteousness was found in you. In the abundance of your trade, you were filled with violence in your midst, and you sinned. So I cast you as a profane thing from the mountain of God, and I destroyed you, O guardian cherub, from the midst of the stones of fire. Your heart was proud because of your beauty. You corrupted your wisdom for the sake of your splendor. I cast you to the ground. I exposed you before kings to feast their eyes on you. By the multitude of your iniquities and the unrighteousness of your trade, you profaned your sanctuaries. So I brought fire out from your midst, it consumed you, and I turned you to ashes on the earth in the sight of all who saw you. All who know you among the peoples are appalled at you. You have come to a dreadful end and shall be no more forever.
Okay. So, a couple of things should jump out at you. First off, this is a proclamation against who? What does it start? King of Tyre is where we start. But then it says the king of Tyre was where? that he's a cherub, that he was in Eden, that he that doesn't sound like any earthly king. Once again, a condemnation of a king, a condemnation of the spiritual power behind that king. Okay. Now, a couple of other, what else jumps out at you at this one? Although there's probably a lot. Like I said, we could just spend a whole day unpacking this, but. What else?
Full of wisdom and perfect in beauty.
Yep. Anything else?
You were blameless when you were created until unrighteousness was found in you.
Yep. Do we have more mentions of mountains of God again?
From the mountain of God.
There you go. Does this sound like Genesis chapter 3? Yeah. I mean, it does, except with more detail, right? We've got some more interesting detail there. By the way, liberal and conservative scholars that want to fight over this passage want to say, no, this is just a metaphor for the king of Tyre, okay? That is not the way the church saw it, okay? For most of our history, that is not the way the church saw it. The church saw it, no. This is talking about Lucifer. This is talking about the Satan that we know, that we understand, who is in opposition. And this is obviously talking about the serpent that was in the garden, right? We'll come back to serpents later too. Serpent, remember that, okay? We're going to have references to that.
So if that's the case, then what tribe, if they were all divided amongst all the beings and Satan was one of them, and that's who they're talking about, what tribe is that?
What tribe? Well, okay, so...
So the king of Tyre.
Okay, so Tyre is just one of those city-states that's there in the Middle East, and we're talking about a later time period. This is thousands of years actually after that Table of Nations event, the Tower of Babel, that kind of thing. But here's what's fascinating about this. The entire Middle East had a story that was common to them. It's called the Baal cycle. You guys have heard of Baal, maybe, okay? That is a honorific title that was associated with lots of gods, okay? But specifically, the story goes, there was a council of gods. Baal rose up in rebellion and basically took over the king of the gods and became the god himself. And that's what these people believed. And they believed that it was this god that they were supposed to worship. So whenever you hear this reference to Baal worship, that's the mental image that people had, okay? So in particular, Tyre was one of those places that was especially associated with Baal worship. And so this, in their mind, was a direct reference to Baal, or Baal, okay? Who they're saying, this Baal, this person, that's who was in the garden. That's who is referenced there. Now, once again, so we're talking about a whole host of folks who are in rebellion at this point. We tend to think in terms of hierarchies because that's the way God operates. God actually loves hierarchies. We see the hierarchies in the divine council. We see hierarchies within the church. By the way, just put this in your pocket for observation and meditation. We are desperately opposed to hierarchies in the modern world. We don't like them. We are all about equality, flattening. Everybody's the same. That's an Enlightenment idea, guys. It's definitely not an ancient idea, and it's certainly not a Christian idea. The idea of hierarchies is this idea of order, this idea of mutual submission. There is hierarchy within the Trinity itself. Okay, so that's just something. Just keep that in mind when we're out marching in the streets about, equality and stuff. And hey, there's good things that come from equality before the law, and equality in the eyes of God, that kind of thing. But anyway, something to think about. Okay, so here's what's crazy. If you go back and you study that Baal cycle about this idea that the gods, there was this one god that was in rebellion, and he actually rose up and he killed his like leader god and then took the throne for himself. The Israelites were telling a story that's similar but different. In their view, it's like, yeah, this Baal guy you guys talk about? Yeah, he didn't take the throne. You understand that, right? He's in rebellion, And he tried to take the throne, but he didn't take the throne. That's not how this worked. If you start looking at other stories, these cosmological, theological stories out of the Middle East, you begin to see that story repeated. You see this story with the Greeks. When you start reading the story of Zeus and the Titans and all of that stuff, it's all about a god who wanted to be in charge, who had to kill a father to get the throne. And it's Game of Thrones. I mean, that is literally what it is, okay? And then you had this constant usurping of authority and trying to take over. So there is a collective memory of this story, this idea of the gods in rebellion to take over and to therefore demand worship on their terms. You see that in all of these cultures. The Israelites were telling, yeah, that's not the story. You guys have pieces of the story, but that's not the real story. So, all right, let's keep going. Okay, so at this point, I wanted us to have this idea that we've got this disinheritance. We've got this character in rebellion. You've got other rebels. But I also want us to keep in mind this idea of this divine council kind of courtroom of God. And I want you guys to see that this is not the only place we see it. We're going to see it in a lot of other places. All of a sudden, this really starts to make more sense when you see the experience that some of the people of God have. So you can start by talking about, you know, Adam literally walked on the cosmic mountain with God. I mean, it was in many ways a reflection of the throne room of God in so many ways. But later on, you have a person like Enoch, and it says he walked with God. Remember, we had Noah, and it said he walked with God, this idea of walking in communion somehow, and God spoke to them. And but from this point forward, we have individuals who either are transported to the divine council throne room of God, or who have the council throne room of God transported to them. And so we see it first with Moses. Now I want you to think about Moses' first experience with Yahweh. Where was it? On a mountain, with a burning bush, on holy ground. It was a tree that was not consumed, that was filled with fire, right? Okay, so he has that first experience. Does he have another experience on a mountain? Okay, so I want us to go to Exodus 24. So everybody go to Exodus 24. This is so cool. This is something that until, I guess, about a year or so ago, I had never really paid attention to. And that is, what did it look like whenever Moses got the Ten Commandments? Because we know that Moses led the people of Israel out of the land of Egypt. And after they come out of the land of Egypt, Moses takes them before Mount Sinai, the mountain of God, and he goes up. And how many of you guys, well, first off, what did it look like? In your mind, what did that look like? Was he by himself when he went up the mountain? Well, okay, I'm just thinking. In the popular, our idea. Okay. Question. How many of your images of Moses going up on the mountain is Charlton Heston? That's me. I mean, there's a whole lot more that happens that's not in the movie, okay? It's very, very different. Yes, read the book. Read the book. Okay. So everybody go to 24, okay? All right. In 24 here, this is after God has basically made this covenant with the Israelites, okay? And this is to affirm the covenant, okay? So this is kind of afterward, okay? It says, starting in verse 24, he said to Moses, come up to the Lord, you and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel, and you shall worship at a distance. Moses alone, however, shall come near to the Lord, but they shall not come near, nor shall the people come up with him. Then Moses came and recounted to the people all the words and all the Lord and all the ordinances, and all the people answered with one voice and said, all the words which the Lord has spoken we will do. Moses wrote down all the words of the Lord. Then he rose early in the morning, built an altar at the foot of the mountain with 12 pillars for the 12 tribes of Israel. And he sent young men of the sons of Israel, and they offered burnt offerings and sacrificed young bulls as peace offerings to the Lord. Moses took half the blood, put it in basins. The other half of the blood he sprinkled on the altar. He took the book of the covenant and read it in the hearing of the people. And they said, "All that the Lord has spoken we will do, and we will be obedient." So Moses took the blood and sprinkled it on the people and said, "Behold the blood of the covenant, which the Lord has made with you in accordance with all these words." Then Moses went up with Aaron, Nadab, Abihu, and the 70 of the elders of Israel, and they saw the God of Israel, and under his feet there appeared to be pavement of sapphire, as clear as the sky itself. Yet he did not stretch out his hand against the nobles of the sons of Israel, and they beheld God, and they ate and drank. Now the Lord said to Moses, "Come up to me on the mountain and remain there, and I will give you the stone tablets with the law and the commandments which I've written for their instruction." So Moses arose with Joshua, his servant, and Moses went up to the mountain of God. But to the elders he said, "Wait here for us till we return. And behold, Aaron and Hur are with you. Whoever has a legal matter, let him approach them." Then Moses went up to the mountain, and the cloud covered the mountain. And the glory of the Lord rested on Mount Sinai, and the cloud covered it 6 days. And on the seventh day, he called to Moses from the midst. And to the eyes of the sons of Israel, the appearance of the glory of the Lord was like a consuming fire on the mountaintop. And Moses entered the midst of the cloud as he went up to the mountain, and Moses was on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights. Okay, how many of you guys are familiar with that little bit of, you know, story about Sinai? I wasn't. I've been teaching this stuff for a long time. Until recently, I'd never seen that passage where Moses has this experience, comes down, but then brings back how many elders?
70.
Keep that number in mind. That's something we're going to see. Have we seen this number already? Yes. Have we seen the number 12? Are we going to see it again? Yes. We're going to see that. That's going to be important, okay? So, how is this described? Like, he goes up, like, I just think of the mountain, right? But what, how is it described? This doesn't sound like a mountain. What does it sound like?
It sounds like something from Revelation. He's talking about heaven.
Okay.
And the
beast. Sounds like Revelation, right? We're talking about gems and stones, and like the language they have is just this idea of beauty and extraordinary wonder and all this kind of stuff. By the way, what did the elders do? They had a feast. They ate. Remember, we talked about this a little bit before, this idea of worship and association with a feast. You ate. It's going to be important when we get to Abraham as well. Who else went with them? There's only a couple of folks that are mentioned by name. You got Aaron, you got the other two, those poor guys. We know who Aaron is, but who knows who Nadab and Abihu are? I mean, really. But there is another name.
Joshua.
Notice, he took Joshua with him, okay? That's another fascinating thing I'd never noticed. So here is Moses going up with the elders, and they saw God, okay? They beheld God in this court type of experience, okay? If you go to Joshua, so we mentioned already that Joshua was there in Exodus 24, so he was with Moses when this happened. Go over to Deuteronomy 31, 14 through 23. So let's flip over there. Who wants to read that one? I told you guys we'd be all over the place today. Somebody want that one? Whoever gets there first. Go ahead and start. 14 through 23.
To other gods. Now, therefore, write this song and teach it to the
through 23.
And when many evils and troubles have come upon them, this song shall confront them as a witness, for it will live unforgotten in the mouths of their offspring. For I know what they are inclined to do even today, before I have brought them into the land that I swore to give. So Moses wrote this song the same day and taught it to the people of Israel. And the Lord commissioned Joshua the son of Nun and said, be strong and courageous, for you shall bring the people of Israel into the land that I swore to give them. I will be with you.
Okay, so Joshua gets a lot of the same experiences Moses has because Moses brings him along. And right before Joshua's commissioning, he has this experience. There is another experience where Joshua, it is said, stayed behind. Like Moses actually leaves the tent and Joshua stays behind. So God actually has a conversation with just Joshua. So he has this experience that nobody else gets to see behind this cloud, okay? So let's go to Isaiah 6, 1 through 8. Whoever gets there first, just start reading. And then we're going to also go to Ezekiel chapter 1 and 2. So, like I said, whoever gets there first, go for it.
My mouth and said, behold, this has touched your lips. Your guilt is taken away. Your sin is atoned for.
Go ahead.
And I heard the voice of the Lord saying, whom shall I send and who will go for us? Then I said, here I am, send me.
Okay. So, once again, what do we have? We have a prophet, and this is kind of what makes a prophet. A prophet is somebody that gets to go literally into the presence of God and has direct commandments spoken for him, okay? And in this particular passage, what do you see? What do you see in the throne room of God?
It's weird.
It's weird, right? What else? Like, why is it weird? What kinds of angels? Yep. Weird sounding angels, by any chance? You know, you've got, then one of the seraphim flew to me with, they've got burning coals, and you've got seraphim with six wings, with over their face and over their feet, and then two, okay, this is different, okay? This is a very different, this is not like the little bitty baby, you know, things that we see in Renaissance art, this idea of, they're called putti is what literally what they're called. Yeah, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about terrifying beings, spiritual creatures, okay? And then you have Isaiah being commissioned. How about Ezekiel? Let's go over to Ezekiel and you can see the same kind of thing. I'll read this for us. It came about in the 30th year on the 5th day of the 4th month while I was by the river Chebar among the exiles. The heavens were opened and I saw visions of God. Okay. And then if you go down a little bit, you get to verse 4. And I looked, behold, a storm wind was coming from the north, a great cloud with the flashing forth continually and a bright light around it in the midst, something like a glowing metal in the midst of the fire. Within it were figures resembling four living beings, and which was their appearance. They had human form. Each had four faces and four wings, and their legs were straight, and their feet were like a calf's hoof, and they gleamed like burnished bronze. Under their wings and on their four sides were human hands, and as for the face and wings of the four of them, their wings touched one another. Their faces did not turn. When they moved, each went straight forward. As for the form of their faces, each had the face of a man. Okay, we can just keep going. Verse 13, in the midst of the living beings, there was something that looked like burning coals of fire, like torches darting back and forth among the living beings. The fire was bright, and lightning was flashing from the fire. The living beings ran to and fro like bolts of lightning. And I looked at the living beings, and behold, there was one wheel on the earth. Okay, we keep going and going and going. Verse 22, Now, over the heads of the living beings, there was something like the expanse, like the awesome gleam of crystal extended over their heads. Under the expanse, their wings were stretched out straight, one towards the other, each one with two wings covering their bodies on one side and on the other. And they also heard the sound of their wings like the sound of a bunch. Okay. Go back and read it. Weird, right? Really weird. But echoes of the same thing Isaiah saw. And by the way, you want to flip forward and go to Revelation? Similar. Very similar to what some of the things that John saw. And by the way, once again, going back to angels, do you really want to see an angel? Because there's a passage in C.S. Lewis's Space Trilogy where a guy comes in contact with one of these angelic beings, and he shows up, and it's like this. It's like all feathers, eyeballs, wings, and the guy just throws up. And then the angel steps back, and he goes, "Is this better?" And he looks back up, and he's like, "Okay, I can handle that." And so, yeah, I mean, you know, these are awful creatures in the sense of they fill you with awe, right? Because they're so very different. Then Jeremiah does the same thing. We're going to skip a little bit. If you want to read Jeremiah, has also a similar calling and a similar experience where he enters into the throne room of God. This is actually an icon that portrays the calling of Isaiah. Notice he's over here getting the coal of fire touched to his lip. This is actually in the Hagia Sophia, which was at one point the largest church in Christendom in Constantinople, what is today Istanbul, and has been converted into a mosque. So here's what happens. We have this disinheritance, but we have an inheritance that focuses on one people group. That one people group is sent into a land that didn't belong to them. When we get to chapter 12, we're going to have the calling of one guy, Abraham. And guess where Abraham is from? Ur of the Chaldees, the heart of Babylon. And he's pulled out of Babylon and sent to a new location, this area called Canaan. But it's not going to be easy because everywhere he goes and everywhere his children go, What's going to happen? They're going to run into another group of people who have a different Elohim, and they don't like Yahweh. So you're going to see fights over and over and over. And that's the thing you've got to understand about the conquest period in Israel's history, specifically the book of Joshua and Judges and all that. You're going to constantly have this animosity towards the people of Israel because of the powers and principalities behind those thrones. That hatred is not just human, it's supernatural. That people group that was inherited by Yahweh is reviled by the other rebel Elohim. And you're going to see that over and over. And frankly, Yahweh knows that his people are going to give up on him from time to time and go after these other Elohims, because they will. And that's why there's so many prohibitions over and over. Don't worship the other gods. This is not just a matter of personal preference. Because if you do, you'll enslave yourself to them. And that's much of what is happening when God turned these nations over to these other lesser Elohims. They became enslaved to those Elohims to do what those Elohims wanted them to do. So we're going to close out with this today. Zechariah 14, 1 through 5. Who wants to read that one for us? You got it. And Isaiah 24, 21 through 23. Got it. And Isaiah 66, 16 through 22. Who wants that one? Need one more. You got it? Okay. All right. Let's go. Zechariah.
Behold, a day is coming for the Lord when the spoil taken from you will be divided in your midst. For I will gather all the nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the city shall be taken, and the house plundered, and the women raped. Half of the city shall go out into exile, but the rest of the people shall not be cut off from the city. Then the Lord will go out and fight against those nations as when he fights on a day of battle. On that day his feet shall stand on the Mount of Olives that lies before Jerusalem on the east. And the Mount of Olives shall be split in two from east to west by a very wide valley, so that one half of the mount shall be moved northward, and the other half southward. And you shall flee to the valley of my mountains. For the valley of the mountains shall reach to Azal, and you shall flee as you fled from the earthquake in the days of Uzziah king of Judah. Then the Lord my God will come, and all the holy ones with him.
Okay, so Here's a reference to all of the nations coming at Jerusalem. And what does it say? Yahweh himself is going to come fight. And he's going to land on the Mount of Olives. And he's going to bring the holy ones with him. Okay? So that's thing number one. Let's go to Isaiah 24.
In that day, the Lord will punish the fallen angels in the heavens and the proud rulers of the nations on earth. They will be rounded up and put in prison until they are tried and condemned. Then the Lord Almighty will mount his throne on Mount Zion. He will rule gloriously in Jerusalem in the sight of all the leaders of his people. There will be such glory that the brightness of the sun and moon will seem to fade away.
All right. And tell you what, let's go. Did you do through 23?
Yeah.
Okay. The Lord of hosts will reign on Mount Zion in Jerusalem. His glory will be before his elders, is another passage there. Okay. 66.
For by fire will the Lord enter into judgment, and by his sword with all flesh. And those slain by the Lord shall be many. Those who sanctify and purify themselves to go into the gardens, following one in the midst, eating pig's flesh and the abomination and mice, shall come to an end together, declares the Lord. For I know their works and their thoughts, and the time is coming to gather all nations and tongues. And they shall come and shall see my glory, and I will set a sign among them. And from them I will send survivors to the nations, to Tarshish, Pul, and Lud, who draw the bow to Tubal and Javan, to the coastlands far away, that have not heard my fame or seen my glory. And they shall declare my glory among the nations, and they shall bring all your brothers from all the nations as an offering to the Lord, on horses and in chariots and in litters and on mules and on dromedaries, to my holy mountain Jerusalem, says the Lord, just as the Israelites bring their grain offering in a clean vessel to the house of the Lord, and some of them also I will take for priests and for Levites, says the Lord. For as the new heavens and the new earth that I make shall remain before me, says the Lord, so shall your offspring and your name remain.
All right. So what we have here is an explanation of this idea that God is going to come back and he's going to judge the other nations. And he's going to judge the powers behind those other nations, and he's going to bring them all back to Jerusalem, and eventually everyone's going to worship at his holy hill. And the word that they use there is Zion, which is where the temple is, which is where Jerusalem, you know, Jerusalem and the temple on Mount Zion. It's another holy mountain of God. We see that once again. So, just like I thought, we got about through half of what I wanted to do today. So what do we do with this? I guess what I hope, because here's what we're going to do next week. Next week, we're going to look at Daniel chapter 7, which is really kind of the last thing I wanted to get to. Because if you guys remember Chris's teachings on chapter 7, Daniel saw some of this stuff too, okay? He saw this idea of kingdoms. And by the way, the kingdoms were always represented as what? Beasts. These weird beasts, okay? These weird descriptions of beasts. And they all eventually get judged, right? And specifically, they get judged by this character, this son of man. Like, who is this son of man? He sees a throne room of God, just like the other prophets. I saw in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, there came one like a son of man. And he came to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. And to him was given domain and glory and a kingdom, that all peoples, nations, languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed. This is a fascinating passage because it's got a reference to two things going on here. You've got the Ancient of Days, which is Yahweh, but you've also got this son of man who comes to the Ancient of Days. And this is actually something that in Second Temple Judaism they struggled with. Because who is this? There's two people here. There's two things going on. And there was this worry that this passage would promote polytheism in some way. As we'll see next week, all of this points in one direction. It points to somebody who says, I am the son of man. It points to someone who is going to stand on the Mount of Olives. And it's going to point to someone who didn't just come and live and die for your sins. He came back to reestablish an entire cosmic order, to take nations back, to judge the rebellion amongst the Elohim, and to rightly reorder Eden. It's a bigger story. We're part of it, and that's amazing, and it's awesome, and our forgiveness and our adoption into the family is definitely part of the story. The atoning for our sin is part of the story. But it's so much bigger than that, because he's going to attack the only weapon that the Elohim have keeping everybody in slavery, and that's death. That's all the enemy had is death. And when Christ comes, he defeats that, and he takes the weapon away. We'll get to that next week. So, let me pray for us. Father in heaven, we thank you so much for this, your word, the integrity of your scripture. Father, it is hard to understand. The depth and the complexity, it's your riches. Father, help us to understand. And Father, I pray that it would create a greater faith in us to trust you more, to follow you more, and to desire in our hearts to be more like your Son. And we pray all these things in the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. All right, guys. See y'all next week. We'll pick up with Daniel.